Hello and welcome to Provox, a podcast from the Queen's College, Oxford.
First of all, I just wanted to say thank you so much, Jeremy, for coming along. Incredibly kind of you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. I've already said this to Jeremy, that for those of you expecting a Paxman-style inquisition, that's not what this is going to be. It's an attempt to have an interesting conversation about what has been an extraordinary life, really. Jeremy, and we might talk about this a little bit, studied PPE at Oxford, actually in the same year as me, and indeed as Nick Owen, sitting in front of us. And bizarrely, in the same year as Ed Balls, David Cameron, and Ed Davey, and possibly others, but that was a pretty extraordinary. I mean, I am the mega underachiever of the of that cohort of PPEists. I think I can't remember her name. Dido Harding as well was in that same year. So a fairly unusual year, or perhaps not unusual, but for the PPE students here, you have much to aspire to. If you don't make it to at least Chancellor, then you've got further to go. You then went on to sort of be a businessman and entrepreneur, then a politician, and Secretary of State for Culture, Secretary of State for Health, Foreign Secretary and Chancellor. That's pretty a pretty remarkable set of things. Now, we're not going to have time in those 40 minutes that I'm going to speak and then 20 minutes of questions to cover all of that. And I'm going to probably keep off the things about which I know nothing, I mean, including culture, I'm afraid, and foreign policy. But we'll talk a bit about some of those other things, and I hope about the current state of politics. Let's start actually with PPE at Oxford, because this is obviously something that certainly some members of the audience are doing. I mean, there's a little bit of a pushback in some of the press about, you know, the world is run by PPEists. I mean, and this is part of the problem. I mean, what did you gain from PPE? I mean, do you think it is part of the problem that the world is run by PPEists?
Well, I had a terrible guilty secret, which I was terrified would emerge while I was Chancellor, which is I actually dropped economics after 1 year. I didn't really enjoy it, and focused on politics and philosophy. And actually, philosophy was the one that I really enjoyed more, and enjoyed studying politics, but it wasn't my big passion. I don't think it matters one way or the other. I mean, I was at Magdalen, so just a bit further down the high street, and there was this kind of surreal moment when David Cameron became Prime Minister, when we realised that there were four Magdalen people in the cabinet: me, George Osborne, William Hague, and Chris Hune. And within 4 years, or within 6 years, they'd all gone except for me, and one of them had gone to prison. So, you know, that is kind of like a bit of a morality tale in there. But I think it is absolutely right to ask whether the structure we have, where large government departments are run by, for want of a better phrase, gentlemen amateurs, who have often done PPE, is the right thing. And I think that the answer is that I think it is right that in a democracy, the ultimate decision is taken by someone who's elected. But it really depends on having someone who has a sensible relationship with their civil servants, who are the people who have the institutional memory. I mean, Paul and I both know the civil servants at the Treasury very well. And they, you know, they are super smart, very principled, very decent people. And, you know, you have to know when you need to listen to people who know a lot more than you do on, you know, all these difficult topics.
It's like listening to your tutors.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, when I became Chancellor, by the way, which very nearly didn't happen, because I was, you know, I was happily on the back benches, and this is sort of part of the madness of politics, and I was on holiday with my wife in Brussels. And on a Friday morning, I got a text message saying, "Liz Truss here, please call." And I thought, it's got to be a hoax. And I completely ignored it. And you know, then by the evening I was Chancellor and the markets were collapsing around our ears. And I had no background in financial services or the city. I mean, I don't think if you'd asked me what a bond yield was, I would have known whether it was a good thing for them to be high or low.
I mean, they'd be collapsing even more if they'd known that.
I knew who you were, Paul, but, you know, and so that was a moment. But I think if you'd been a fly on the wall, actually, you'd have been quite impressed with the quality of the discussions, the quality of the civil servants, the way we crunch through the issues. So I think it can work.
Yeah. I mean, Liz Truss, of course, also did PPE.
Okay.
It has its downsides. In terms of the politics, you were, I think, a Conservative at Oxford. I mean, you were chair of the, or president of the Oxford University Conservative Association. I mean, what made you a Conservative? I mean, and did you ever think you might not be? I mean, in a sense, your sort of background, you think you're in a sense a very sort of very typical Conservative, if I might say, a sort of reasonably privileged background, a nice school, Oxford. Did you ever think maybe I'm not a Conservative, or was this something that you always thought you were?
When I came here, I mean, I wanted to believe that I was deciding which party or which ideology I supported with a totally open mind when I arrived as a PPE student. So I went along to the Conservative Association, to the Labour Club, to the clubs of various political parties. The Labour Club, at the time, the Labour leader was Neil Kinnock, and they had a speaker called Eric Heffer, who spent the whole meeting saying what a terrible man Neil Kinnock was.
That's something would never happen in the Conservative Party nowadays.
I ended up deciding I believed in what the Conservatives are saying. But, you know, as you say, I did come from a very Conservative background, and I'm sure that that was probably fairly inevitable. And I actually think what happens is that we naturally hone in on, you know, something that we're comfortable with because of our background. But then life happens, and that can challenge your beliefs and your belief systems. And in my case, you know, when I was at Oxford, I was a small state libertarian, uber Thatcherite conservative. And then I ended up as health secretary for 6 years, responsible for, you know, the largest, most expensive public service in the Western world. And that probably did push me more to the centre, because you realise how so many people are just utterly dependent on having an NHS, and how, for all its faults, it is actually a totally fantastic thing that we have an NHS in this country, and there are still big countries like America that don't.
So, I mean, going back to the 1980s, that was the heyday of Thatcherism, and the country was pretty divided in its views. But obviously, the Conservatives were winning quite big majorities in 1983 and 1987. Did you feel in a sort of small minority among students at that time,
I was in my college. I was a minority of one. I remember there was a motion on the poll tax, which you will remember, Paul, but most people here probably won't have heard of. But it was a very controversial tax that Mrs. Thatcher wanted to introduce. It was totally regressive. You paid the same tax. It was a replacement for local taxation, what we used to call the rates, now the council tax. And it was very unfair tax, and she decided to introduce this, and I dutifully went along to a JCR debate to support the government line.
That's courageous.
And as I was walking over to this debate, I had a great friend in the college who was a postgraduate student, and she said, what are you doing? Come along and see this debate. And she came along and she saw a debate in which literally the person defending the government was in a minority of one. There was a whole room full of everyone else saying what the government's doing is absolute rubbish. And it was a very civilized, good-humoured, I think it was a good-humoured debate partly because I was in such a minority. People thought I was a good sport. But the interesting thing, I don't know whether that had any influence, but that person That was 1988. She went back to China and became one of the demonstrators in Tiananmen Square.
Oh, gosh.
And very, very brave. And luckily, she was all right. But I did feel, you know, that we sometimes forget what a total privilege it is to be able to have these debates. And actually, frankly, university is the moment when all that really starts.
And I mean, there's a real lesson there, the importance of, you know, as they'd say on the rest, it's politics to be able to disagree agreeably, which is an important part of politics. But I mean, can you get a bit more at why you know, why viscerally you're a conservative?
Okay, I think viscerally I'm a conservative because I've got lots and lots of Labour friends, and I would say that most of the time I don't think that there's any real difference in values. You know, we all want a prosperous country with good public services, which makes provision for people in difficulty, but people to work hard and businesses to be. So most Labour people want that, most Conservatives want that. But in the end, there is a choice you have to make about chickens and eggs. And Conservatives, in my experience, always say the economy comes first. So when you are looking at, when you can only, for example, reduce taxes in a way that's going to grow the economy, or you can decide to put money into public services, the Conservatives will generally say the thing that's going to grow the economy has to come first, because everything else follows from that. People on the left would tend to say, no, put money into public services, because that itself will help economic growth, will make people more educated, will increase our human capital, etc. They would find lots of reasons why it's okay to go straight into things that expand the state. So I think that it's a sequencing thing. I think that we want to have great public services, but it has to come after we've grown the economy and not before.
I think Labour politicians would also say they would care more about inequality, for example, than Conservatives might do. And obviously one of the big changes this country experienced in the 1980s was a huge increase in inequality. Now, interesting, it hasn't changed much since about 1990, but it's settled at a very high level. Is that something that you think maybe the 1980s government's got wrong by not doing enough to assuage that, or to slow down change, or to help those who are impacted by the economic change at the time? Because, I mean, as you'll know, there are still plenty of people around who really hate what happened in the 1980s and what the Conservative governments did then, and you know, others who may have come to the view that, in a sense, we've got a lot of additional economic growth because of the liberalisation that happened there, but maybe the social cost was too great. Or maybe your view is that was just inevitable and we have to live with that because that was the only way of getting growth.
It's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, certainly when I was a student at Oxford, I was cocooned in quite a privileged upbringing. I grew up in a Surrey village, and I think in truth, we didn't really know the incredible devastation that was happening in the north of the country, as you know, huge swathes of manufacturing industry were being closed down. If there were 3 million unemployed, you know, they weren't generally around Guildford. And so I don't think we had the full picture. And that's why it was easier to be a sort of card-carrying Thatcherite in that kind of context. So I think that is a fair comment. I think, and in fact, you and I have had this discussion, it's really difficult. I think with the benefit of hindsight, and you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing in politics, the deep recession, the high unemployment, some of that could have been avoided if with the same results in terms of our competitiveness. For example, you know, Margaret Thatcher in her early days took a very narrow view of monetarism. and that caused a huge amount of austerity in the economy as the money supply was drastically reduced. And, you know, Nigel Lawson decided actually that wasn't the right approach and moved away from that. But it was very, very tough in those early days. But I think it is also fair. So, yes, the human cost was huge and things could have been done to reduce the impact of that. And there was a harshness about that period. But on the other hand, if you look at the country that Margaret Thatcher inherited, it was pretty dire. You know, it wasn't a fake, we've inherited an absolute nightmare from the last lot. It was absolutely terrible. We had this thing called the Winter of Discontent. And I think there is an argument that actually we did need some kind of an electric shock. And I think that, you know, to her credit, the thing that was impressive about her, love her or loathe her, is that first of all, her motives were absolutely not about herself. She was very clear it was about the country, and she had a plan and she stuck to it. And I think that sense of resolve is missing today. And people, you know, because I think she would have been 100 last week, people are feeling a bit, you know, where is that proper sense of direction of a government that really knows what it wants to do and is getting on with it?
Well, we'll come on to the present day. Sorry for students here, this probably sounds like ancient history, but you know, we lived through the 1980s, and I completely accept that that government inherited a bit of a disaster. We can come on to whether this government has also inherited a bit of a disaster from its predecessors in a minute. But let's move on in time a bit. Actually, one thing I did want to say on the economics of that, I think economists, I think, are increasingly of the view that markets don't mop up in the way that I think perhaps a decade or two ago they might have thought. When shocks hit in a sort of perfectly competitive market, you get unemployment, and then broadly speaking, other jobs will appear, and firms will move into the affected areas, and things will in the end become okay. And I, one of the things I think has happened in the US when the China shock hit. Whole communities may have became unemployed, and actually they weren't redistributed towards very much. And even to the extent they were, that wasn't adequate compensation for the loss of jobs, for the loss of community, and so on. I think that actually poses quite a lot of really difficult challenges for economists and politicians managing economic change. And we can still see the consequences of economic change in the 1980s in the sort of geography of the current UK economy. So I think, you know, we've learned something since that time, but clearly what happened in the 1980s it still has cast quite a shadow. And part of the reason it casts a shadow is we've now had a long period of very poor growth off the back on the back of a very unequal population. But we'll come back to that, because I don't want to talk a bit about your time as health secretary. Sorry to skip over the intervening 20 years or more. But I think it's really interesting to those of us who have not worked in the health service. What is your diagnosis of, I mean, this is a really big question, but we know that we spend about £200 billion a year on the NHS. The amount we spend has grown continually in real terms as a share of the economy, as a share of total public spending, and yet it never seems to be quite good enough. You're the longest ever serving health secretary, so what's your sense of why it's so hard to end up with an NHS that people are actually happy with?
I think you have to sort of separate short-term challenges and long-term strategic challenges. And the health service right now is going through a very difficult patch because we had a once-in-a-century pandemic, which added millions of people to the waiting list. And that was just, you know, people working in the NHS did a fantastic job in the pandemic, but it was a body blow to the system, and it's never quite got back on its feet post-pandemic. But putting that aside, there are some big challenges that we've got, obviously with an aging population, with the discovery of new medicines, with the arrival of genomics and the possibility of being able to prevent medicines by looking at, by decoding every single person's genome. This is going to potentially massively increase the cost of medicine and make the cost of universal provision, for which the NHS was the first, we were the first large country in the world to properly put in place universal provision back in 1948. And it has, across the world since then, become the definition, part of the definition of a civilized country, that no matter who you are, rich or poor, young or old, you should be able to get the healthcare you need. Only America and the big countries.
I think it's really important to understand that we often seem to believe that the NHS is some way, we're somehow unique in having free at the point of use health. It's just not true. I mean, most countries, but certainly most European countries and many others do. It's the US that's the outlier.
Yeah. And, if you had a blank sheet of paper, you could look at different countries which have universal provision and see that they have better outcomes for the same or sometimes lower cost. Or you look at countries like Australia or the Netherlands or Israel, for example. But the reality that's now dawning on everyone is that, OECD countries, the advanced economies, spend on average about 9% of their GDP on health. In the UK, it's about 10%. And that is not going to dramatically change going forward, because we're in a world where it doesn't matter if you're left or right, really bond markets are as influential in setting fiscal policy as chancellors or finance ministers. And, whether you're a conservative finance minister who wants to cut taxes, if you're a Labour one who wants to increase spending, there are limits imposed by, for various reasons, which maybe we're going to come on to talk to.
Yeah, I was more interested in the management of the NHS.
Therefore, the question is, what can you do? And this is what I think needs to happen. So you have to find a way within a state system of making sure that there are the disciplines that you would have in a private system that would drive up standards. In the private system, there's competition and people move around. There's not always access to information that allows you to do that in a private system. And that's one of the problems in healthcare. So I think what you want to do, you need to have complete transparency. And that was probably the thing that I focused on the most. We're the only health system in the world where the CQC independently rate hospitals as outstanding good, requires improvement or inadequate. And that is a real pressure on hospitals where the care is not good quality to improve. But there's something I didn't do, which, with the benefit of hindsight, I made a start on, but I think is really the heart of the problem with the NHS that we have today. It's the largest healthcare system in the world. It's the fifth largest employer in the world. Only the Chinese Army, the American Department of Defense, McDonald's and Walmart. They are the only four organizations in the world.
I always thought it was the Indian Railways.
No, the Indian Railways has been, the NHS has more employees than the Indian Railways, and maybe because it's been divided up. So it's enormous. And we have chosen to micromanage it from Westminster, either NHS England or the Department of Health, in a way that no other healthcare system in the world does. So if you take the John Radcliffe at Oxford down the road, a huge, very, very complex organization, the chief executive there has 18 monthly operational targets around A&E waiting times, elective care waiting times, cancer waiting times, 18 of these, and they're monthly. And there is someone in London who is constantly on the phone to this poor soul saying, what are you going to do to improve, let's be honest, the September figures were a bit of a disappointment. What are you going to do to improve the October ones? And the result is that they are kept on this incredibly short leash. This wouldn't happen if you were running a hospital in America or France or Germany or Singapore or anywhere else in the world. If you're a GP, you have 44 targets. At least they're annual. They're not monthly, but you have 44 what are called QOF targets. And the money you get is directly related to whether you meet these targets. And the result is that any kind of longer term strategic transformation, the kind of obvious thing you would do if you arrive at a hospital, like put in a new IT system to make it more efficient, to reduce waste or whatever, gets sidelined. It gets really difficult to do that. And everything you basically, you know, the way you're going to get promoted is to do something on those 18 operational targets. And what we need to do is, so I think there's a model that works in the British state, which is our state schools. We've gone completely the opposite direction with state schools. And state schools, we basically say to governing bodies, here's your budget. We're going to publish your exam results. You've got Ofsted. But after that, it's broadly up to you. And in the state sector, our state schools have now become some of the best in the world. We have the highest reading standards in Western Europe. We have maths that is, you know, just a notch behind Korea, Taiwan, Shanghai, and so on. And there is innovation happening on the ground. You have the academy chains, a system to sort out schools that are failing. And I think if we want the NHS to take off, we've got to get rid of this learned helplessness at a local level where everyone is looking over their shoulder to NHS England, the Department of Health, and actually give people autonomy at a local level with full transparency and consequences if they don't turn things around, but also the power to enact change locally, which has largely been taken out of people's hands.
So your diagnosis would be that hospital trusts need significantly greater autonomy than they currently have.
Absolutely. If you gave the John Radcliffe, if you or the Integrated Care Board for Oxford and Oxfordshire, if you gave them the money and said, look, we're going to publish how well you do, the whole world's going to see, but you have got 2 billion quid here, get on and transform services, you would have a wave of exciting new innovations happening that aren't happening at the moment.
I mean, that's we know that there are, you know, real management problems across the NHS. We talked, you will have done this more than I have, but you talk to people of many parts of the NHS, they'll talk about the dreadful IT systems, they'll talk about the very poor management, they'll talk about the poor infrastructure and all of those sorts of things. It's not, it feels like it's more fundamental than the amount of autonomy people have, because the hospitals have the autonomy to sort out their IT systems and do better people management and so on. I mean, I'm not sure whether that's right.
I know. I think that very much less so than you might think. For example, I wanted to get a new cancer centre built at my local hospital in Guildford, and they actually had the money to build it. But they had to get permission from NHS England to use their own money because it counted towards the NHS's capital total, and so there was an approval process. And I had to go to Simon Stevens, who obviously I knew luckily because I'd been health secretary, and get him to personally unblock 20 million of funding, which the local hospital already had, but they weren't being given permission to spend. So it's a bull's aching process, frankly, to get anything changed in the NHS. And but more to the point is you take up so much of a chief executive's brain space by these targets that they are being pressurized to meet month in, month out, that the bandwidth they have to do longer term changes is much more constrained. So some of them do it, but they have to be like superhuman to do it. And that's why our IT systems in hospitals are so much worse than in nearly every country, despite spending the fifth highest in the OECD as a proportion of our GDP on health. So, you know, all those many other countries with much better IT systems as a proportion of their GDP are actually spending more than we do.
Well, interestingly, when we were just chatting 10 minutes ago, you were saying that when you were Secretary of State, I mean, you had a unit whose job was to, as it were, go in and, you know, sort out those hospitals that weren't doing very well. So there's sort of, on the one hand, there is this kind of sense that autonomy would work. But on the other hand, there is both a political and a sort of social need to, you know, it's the founding principle, wasn't it? I mean, the idea that Nye Bevan's saying if a bedpan drops in Tredegar or whatever, then, you know, Whitehall will shake. It's there remains that sense that from the centre, you do have to make sure you have to let go, and that's really hard, isn't it?
It is, but that's what happens in the state school.
No, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just reason it hasn't happened.
But what happens in the state system is that if a school fails its Ofsted, actually, this has been sadly weakened by the new administration, and I'm very concerned about some of the changes. But basically, what has happened for the last 30 years until this year is that if a school failed its Ofsted, there were really big consequences. They were forced to join an academy change, the leadership was changed, and the result is that poor schools were turned around quite quickly.
But you had 5-6 years as Secretary of State, and obviously you didn't feel you could let go in that way. I mean, I
started that process. I just didn't finish it. I set up the CQC to do the Ofsted inspections. And then basically if a hospital failed at CQC or a care home failed at CQC, there were consequences. And, you know, I'm not trying to blow my own trumpet because there's lots of things I got wrong. But by the time I finished as health secretary, 4 million more patients every year were being treated at good or outstanding hospitals than when I started. So I started on the process. But the thing that I didn't do, which would have completed it, is to get rid of that national target setting. Paul, let me just finish as a... I can talk, as you can see, for far too long on this issue.
Yeah, let me just
tell you, if Bridget Phillotson had a target for the number of A-level, A-grade in physics every summer, she would get officials from the Department for Education to get on the phone to every secondary school in the country and say, how many people have you got doing physics and how many are going to get A's? And what she'd actually do in that process, she'd be setting up NHS England for education and would be starting to micromanage schools. And with 1.5 million employees, it's just never going to work. And that's why we have to learn to empower local areas and trust people on the ground.
Let's talk a bit about your time as Chancellor. Then you came in, as you've described, in a very difficult position. I mean, how much of a hospital pass have you left your successor?
I don't buy. Obviously, I can understand. By the way, I like my successor, and I think she's got a very difficult job. I'm not going to say something negative about her. I completely understand the politics when you want to put up taxes of trying to find something that you were left by your...
Clearly the sort of the idea that there was an unknown black hole when she started was wrong. I mean, I was on the radio every day before the last election saying, there's a black hole. If they come in afterwards and say they didn't know about it, I'm going to get really angry. So I got really angry. But both you and the Labour Party went into the election basically saying, we don't need to cut spending, we don't need to increase taxes, and everything will be fine. Did you really believe that, in the sense that you really could have followed what was in your plans, which would have been no tax increases? And that's actually some really tough spending rounds over this period.
Well, this is something where you and I... I'd be interested to know if we have a real disagreement, but we certainly had a public disagreement at the time about this. Look, on the 22 billion black hole, I think the best thing is to look at what the OBR said.
Yeah, no,
the OBR.
I don't disagree about that, but it's the sort of it's the black hole at the end.
But let's just for a moment look. So the OBR said that at the time of the spring budget last year, my last budget, there was £9.5 billion that they had not seen. There was a £9.5 billion gap, but they also said that could have been dealt with by finding efficiency savings in the period running up to the budget, which is what would have happened in the highly unlikely situation that the Conservative had won the election. And the question is that realistic that we were looking for savings? And I think the answer is that you have to take a strategic view. The long-term solution to not having... By the way, Rachel Reeves has got an even bigger black hole ahead of this budget. And it's quite normal for chancellors 6 months before a budget to have a gap that they need to fill in order to make the numbers add up ahead of a budget. And you get your chief secretary of the Treasury to see what savings can be made in different departments and so on and so forth. So I think Rachel Reeves has found that she's in an identical position to the position that we were in at the time of the last election. But the bigger question is, why are we in this very, very difficult situation fiscally. And you know this far better than me, Paul, because you've been talking about it for far longer. But, you know, we have a combination of debt that has risen to unprecedented levels, nearly 100% of GDP in net terms, interest rates that have risen, that's meant the cost of servicing that debt, it now costs the average household about £4,000 a year in tax. And that's an extraordinary statement that about £4,000 of our taxes every year for the average household is going towards the cost of servicing these enormous...
Servicing the debt costs a bit more than £100 billion a year. It's more than we spend on any public service bar the NHS. And that is a really big... It's a really big part of the problem that the Chancellor faces. I mean, what would you do?
I'm just coming to that. So you've got that problem. And then at the same time, you've got the problem that the economy is not growing. So normally when the economy is growing, you have more tax revenues coming in, and that helps to fund these things. So you have to have a plan that brings growth back into the economy. And that means getting us up from, you know, 1% a year growth to sort of 2.5% to 3% a year. And there are lots of things that need to happen. Some of them the government's doing, some of them not. But planning reform is a very obvious example. But also increasing labour supply, which is what my childcare package was about. The problem with all those measures is that they take 3, 4, 5, 6 years before they start to show through in the numbers. But you need to get cracking on all of those right away. And then the question is, how do you get through that intervening period when public finances are very tight? And I think the only game in town, which happens to be very good for economic growth as well, is welfare reform. And something that I think Rachel Reeves agrees wholeheartedly with. She's had some real challenges. And I think the way she positioned it as a was the wrong way of winning support for those reforms. But let me give you an example of why what I'm talking about and why the numbers are serious. So if we got the welfare bill down to 2019 levels, not for pensions, another discussion, but for working age adults, over the 5 years ahead, that would save about £47 billion a year. So Rachel Reeves wouldn't need to put up a penny of tax. The talking therapy service in the NHS, which is one of the best things the NHS does, it's treatment for people with moderate anxiety and depression. And people come from countries like Sweden to look at how we do it. It's really, really well done. It costs £1 billion a year. Most of the people we're putting on welfare now, it's for anxiety or depression. And we're parking them on welfare, even though any doctor will tell you the one thing you need if you've got anxiety or depression is social contact. So taking people out of the world of work and saying you don't have to look for a job is actually, you know, there's a risk it will make your anxiety or depression worse, not better. We should be treating those people at a fraction of the cost, not making their anxiety or depression worse. So that's what I think the big opportunity. I really hope this government does this, because I think it is frankly immoral what we're doing at the moment. We are making people's illness worse by taking them out of the world of the work. Also, by the way, happens to be very good for economic growth, happens to be good for businesses who need people to, when they're looking to expand. And of course, it helps the fiscal situation. So that is what I would, and that, by the way, has started to go wrong really since the pandemic, because the welfare bill was coming down until that point. So that's where I would be looking at for my shorter term savings.
That there's clearly work to do there. And again, for context, the disability benefit bill is rising incredibly fast over this period, essentially because many, many more people are claiming disability benefits, to the point where something like 1 in 10 of the working age population will be on disability benefits by the end of the decade. And the government's attempted reforms would have slowed that rate of increase. So, we haven't got time to spend on this. I mean, that you know, if you could do something there, that would save a bit, but we're not talking about something that would really sort out the public.
Well, hang on, I'm not going to let that go. I mean, I don't think it's an unreasonable ambition for a government to say that we're going to get the working age benefit bill down to the level it was before the pandemic over a 5-year horizon.
It's that would be a major thing.
Yeah, it would be a major thing, but that is what we should be doing.
And I'm not saying you shouldn't make that attempt. But let's move
but
on.
But the reason I want, I just need to give you the counterfactual. If you don't do that, then what you are going to end up doing is putting up taxes. And the problem with putting up taxes is that one way or another, it dampens growth. And then you end up in a tax doom loop where you're forever putting up taxes. That's having a negative impact on growth. And the problem is getting worse, not better.
Let's people in the audience could ask some questions about this. I do want to spend a bit of time on the politics now. Let's start with the issues facing the sort of, you know, if you look at the polls, Reform appear to be well in the lead. The Conservatives are really doing very poorly in the polls, and I don't think you disagree with me that the record of the last government was not brilliant, and there's obviously quite a lot of discontent among the population with the last government. They're not very happy with this government. There's a movement to reform. There's, you know, arguably a movement to the Greens and Plaid Cymru and all these other sort of more left parties. You'll probably tell me you're optimistic, but how optimistic are you about the future of your party, given that some people are beginning to say, well, maybe they're going to be replaced on the right by Reform. You're down to 120 MPs, lowest ever vote in the last election, and appear to be going downhill from here.
Well, I don't quite agree with your assessment of the last government, Paul.
Well, really?
No, I don't. But I do accept that's what lots of people think. And that's one of the reasons we're doing very badly in the polls. But I think that one of the main reasons people choose Conservative governments is to take tough and difficult decisions to put the economy back on its feet in a crisis.
So how much damage did Liz Truss do?
Well, let me come to that. I'll happily talk about, in a brief way, the whole record. The answer is, well, let's do Liz Truss first. The answer is that within 3 weeks of the decisions that she made, I had reversed everything she did. So the long-term economic scarring was relatively minimal. The political scarring was huge because it was a big mistake and it really scared people. But it was dealt with very, very quickly. But I think the bigger picture, I want to be totally fair here. There were things that we did not sort out. Hopefully, you know, the way I've talked about my time as health secretary indicates, you know, that I don't think I did everything that I would like to have done. I didn't make as much progress on social care, which I know is something of great interest to you, as I would like to have done. We had big problems with the welfare system post-pandemic, which weren't addressed, and I wish we'd done more. But, you know, when the Conservative government came to office in 2010, we were borrowing nearly £1 in every £4 that was being spent. And the whole world was telling us austerity is wrong, it's ideological, it's incredibly damaging, but it was completely unsustainable. We had a deficit of 10% of GDP, and over the period leading up to the pandemic, that deficit was reduced from 10% to 2%. That was very, very difficult politically. When I came into office, as Chancellor, you know, inflation was 11%. Working with the Bank of England, taking very difficult decisions, having a real black hole, by the way, of 72 billion, dealing with that, you know, inflation was down at 2%. I was told we were going to have the longest recession in 100 years by the Bank of England. And that didn't happen. In fact, the economy, after a technical recession, returned to growth. So I think basically, for all our faults, the Conservative governments of that period did do the thing that people need Conservative governments to do most, which is to take difficult decisions.
I think you can make a pretty good defence of 2010 to 2015 in the way that you've just described. So this was the period of austerity. You can have big political arguments about whether it was right or wrong, but it was a rational government, fairly stable and so on. I mean, would you not? I mean, you weren't pro-Brexit. I don't know whether you say at the moment that you think it was a good idea, but certainly at the time you were against it, and I have seen you say other things since. But did we not read whatever you thought of the result of that referendum? Did we not have such a period of, it really was political chaos for those who remember the period from 2016 to 2020? I mean, didn't the government just take their eye off the ball in really quite a big way over that period. And then the sort of machinations within your party, which resulted in all these leaders and the leadership contest. And all. I mean, whatever you think of the rest of the record, didn't that A, damage the, you know, governance of the country? And secondly, is really why people are unhappy with your party?
Quite possibly. We had, I mean, Brexit was this, you know, it was a once in a lifetime political challenge, because the entire British establishment didn't want it to happen, and 52% of the country did. And they said, this is basically a test of whether we are in a democracy or not. We are looking at you now.
They used it to kick the establishment to some extent.
Well, yeah, but they also voted for Brexit. It was very straightforward. And we promised them that if you vote for Brexit, we'll deliver it. And they said, we have now voted for it. And we know you guys don't want it, but we voted for it. And it is a test of our democracy. We want to know whether this is actually a democracy and whether you're actually going to do what you said you were going to do. And it was a very, very big challenge. And we got through it. But there was huge political instability in its wake. You know, the slow death of Theresa May's government, the sudden death of Liz Truss's government, Boris Johnson's defenestration over Partygate. It was a very politically turbulent time. So yes, that is absolutely something people didn't like. And I'm sure that was one of the things that we got punished for. But going forward, of course, people are angry, having had us for 14 years, having disliked the political instability, having been cross about other issues that we didn't address, notwithstanding the things that I think we did get right. But I think ahead of the next election, as it gets closer to an election, people start to look forward, not back. And if we do what opposition parties need to do in British politics, which is come up with solutions that are credible and sensible, as you get closer to an election, you get a hearing. It's harder for us this time, for sure, because we have competition on the right. But, you know, what are reforms saying? They're saying they want to reopen the coal mines in Wales, they want to nationalise the water industries, they want huge tax cuts, and they want to expand the welfare system. I mean, this is not a solution to the problems that you and I have been talking about. And so I think that core area of economic competence is the way that we get back in the race.
We could talk about that for a long time. I mean, are you still proud to be a Conservative?
I am proud. Yes, I am. And I'm, you know, and I think, yeah, I didn't come here, by the way, to give a party political message. But if you give a question like that, then you have to allow me well, to say, I'm going to say why I'm proud of being a Conservative. Because, you know, compared to over the 14 years from 2010, we have an economy that, despite the global financial crisis, which hit the UK harder than many other countries because of our financial sector, a massive deficit, despite the once-in-a-century pandemic, despite the energy crisis caused by the invasion of Ukraine, we grew faster than France, Germany, Italy, or Japan over that 14-year period. 4 million jobs were created, more greenfield foreign direct investment than any country in the world, except for the United States and China. In that period, we developed the world's third largest tech ecosystem, only the third in the world to be worth more than $1 trillion. I mean, I'm spouting the numbers, by the way, at the same time as which our state schools became the best in the Western world. You know, we introduced universal credit, which I think was a very important reform to the benefit system. So there are lots of things on the list that I wish we'd gone further. I wish that, you know, which we've talked about. But I think that is a creditable list, given the challenges we faced.
We've really appreciated you taking the time to come here. It's been interesting, but there's a lot more that we could talk about. Thank you all for coming.
Just before you finish, could I just say one very last, very quick thing, which is I just want to say this one thing. There may be people here this evening who are wondering whether they themselves would like to go into politics. And I just want to say, whichever party it is you're thinking of doing, sometimes you can look at politics and you can look at the grief that politicians get when we're we're put on the spot by people like Paul or by journalists, and you can think, do I really want all of that? And I just want to say, for me, I don't regret a second of it, because it is the most incredible privilege to be able to be part of decisions that can make people's lives better. And it's very, very hard to find. I think that if you're a teacher, you're the same profession. That is absolutely part of that. If you're a doctor or a nurse, but also politicians have huge, huge impact. And so I would just encourage you not to be put off by the negative reputation that the current generation of politicians, I'm sure, have. You know, be the person who goes in and says you're going to change it, because that's what we need.
It's a kind of particular example of the old aphorism that if good people stay silent or don't do things, then the bad people take control. And I think that, is really true in politics. That it needs good people in there. I mean, I think it's a hard job, and it's a hard job to do honestly, and it's a hard job to do with integrity. But if we don't have honest people with integrity taking it on in all parties, then the result is not a good result. So I'd agree with that. I'd also say, working in economic think tanks and indeed in the higher education sector are absolutely excellent things to do. But thank you so much for coming.